Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to those of you joining us here in person in Sacramento, as well as those who are joining us remotely. I'm the chairperson, Janet Hansen, and I'm calling the November 7, 2025 meeting of the State Historical Resources Commission to order at 10:34 a.m. And sorry for the late start, everyone. Today's meeting of the State Historical Resources Commission has been duly noticed. All the agenda items are subject to action by the Commission. Now, would you please stand as you are able and join in the Pledge of Allegiance? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Okay, thank you. As I mentioned, I'm Janet Hansen, this year's chair of the commission, and I represent the discipline of history on the commission, and I'm going to now ask our commissioners to do self-introductions. I'll start with our vice chair.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Renee Villanueva. I'm from Sierra Madre, California, and I represent archaeology.
Hi, everyone. I'm Neil Payton. I'm from Santa Monica, California, and I represent architecture.
All right, down to my right, let's start with Commissioner Cerrillo.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Adam Cerrillo. I'm from Culver City, and I represent archaeology.
Good morning. My name is Lee Adams. I'm from Downeyville in Sierra County, and I represent the public.
All right, thank you. We have two commissioners absent today, Hess and Brandis. And now I'll ask Julie, our State Historic Preservation Officer, to introduce herself and her staff that are present.
Thank you. Good morning. And sorry for the delay, everybody. Our building had a fire drill. So we apologize for people who are waiting. I'm Julie Polanco. I have the honor of being your State Historic Preservation Officer. We have Caleb and Monica in the back from our crew. William Berg and Amy Crane, our award-winning registration unit staff. To the left, Jody Brown, our deputy SHPO and tribal liaison, and Tara Lynch, our amazing chief counsel. Thank you.
Thank you, SHPO Polanco. We generally have our State Parks Director, Armando Quintero, here to do a welcome, but today we have a recorded statement or presentation from him. If we can start the presentation, please.
Good morning, commissioners, and to everyone joining this meeting in person in Sacramento, and for those of you who are online. While I am unable to be with you personally, I will say I have a good excuse for my absence, as today I am joining our Angeles District staff to celebrate the reopening of Will Rogers State Historic Park today and tomorrow to welcome our partners and the local community to this beloved and treasured park. As you are aware, this park, along with much of Topanga State Park, was devastated by the Palisades Fire in January. While the fire destroyed the historic home that once belonged to Will Rogers' family, it was unable to extinguish the spirit of this park or community. The remarkable resilience of this land, Will Rogers' enduring legacy, and the community support is a symbol of hope as the park remains a cherished place of gathering and recreation, with trails and open spaces now once again ready for the public to enjoy. We are deeply grateful to the community, our partners, and our incredible staff to make this day possible, and we look forward to welcoming visitors back safely. Will Rogers isn't the only State Historic Park on the path of recovery. Bidwell Mansion State Historic Park, which was also significantly impacted by fire nearly 1 year ago, is also moving forward. In September, State Parks launched Reimagine Bidwell Mansion State Park, laying the groundwork for the park's recovery following the loss of the mansion from arson in December 2024. This planning effort will take place over the next 12 months and result in a vision plan for the park, which will integrate extensive community, tribal, and stakeholder engagement with technical feasibility and existing condition studies to identify the best path forward for the park. The vision plan will summarize the condition of the remaining structure and explore and explain treatment options, as well as assess the feasibility of a new interpretation and new enhanced visitor experiences and more. Community engagement will be critical to the success of this planning effort, and I encourage anyone wishing to participate in or to follow this process should visit reimaginebidwellmansion.org. And now allow me to highlight a few other recent items of interest to the Commission. In September, State Parks hosted a very successful kickoff event to celebrate California's 175th anniversary of statehood with a birthday block party in front of the west steps of the state capitol in Sacramento. The event was attended by myself, staff from State Parks, representatives from the California Natural Resources Agency, and high-ranking officials from Governor Gavin Newsom's office, the media, and thousands of members of the public. It was a dynamic street party that included music, dancing, and State Parks docents in period dress. There was also a stellar light show set to incredible music. It was really an incredible evening. In addition to the media presence that helped share the celebration with the Californians throughout the state, State Parks Communications and Marketing Division assisted in live streaming the event to be enjoyed by Californians throughout the state in real time. I especially want to thank Superintendent John Fraser and the amazing team from the State Parks Capital District for taking on this huge task and to set the tone for the future anniversary events in California. I'd also like to recognize that November is Native American Heritage Month, and State Parks is celebrating with events throughout the state. Just last week, I participated in the opening of a new exhibit at Santa Cruz Mission State Historic Park, and it's called The People Who Lived Here. The exhibit is comprised of audio recordings and artistic renderings by contemporary Native Americans who share multiple perspectives, difficult details, and tender insights describing the life events of the people who witnessed mission life and its impacts in this space. The exhibit, 3 years in the Planning, was co-created with Native American community members whose ancestors experienced the California mission system and was based on research by Dr. Martin Rizzo Martinez. The exhibit is part of the ongoing work of State Parks through the Reexamining Our Past initiative to identify inadequate interpretive programs or exhibits that fall short in fully contextualizing California's history in state parks. Finally, I'd like to remind U.S. service members and their families who are attending this meeting that they are invited to enjoy free admission on Veterans Day, Tuesday, November 11th, to 142 state parks throughout California in gratitude for their service to this nation. California State Parks is proud to provide free access to veterans who have stood watch and protected our country, and we invite you to rest and find healing and connection within California's most beautiful and cherished natural and historic resources. Service members can find the list of eligible parks by visiting State Parks' website, parks.ca.gov. In closing, commissioners, I want to say thank you for your continued commitment to the important work to support the Office of Historic Preservation and also the mission of California State Parks. I wish you all the very best in your meeting today and during the coming holiday season. Thanks so much.
Okay, we look forward to seeing Director Quintero at a future meeting, and we thank him for his ongoing support to the Commission and the Office of Historic Preservation. Next on the agenda is Commission and staff reports. We do not have a chairperson's report today. May we have the Executive Secretary's report?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just we couldn't hear the very beginning of Director Quintero's remarks. He is at Will Rogers State Park today for a reopening celebration. I give my report, I want to do a bit of housekeeping. We received a letter of objection from the property owner for the Wintersburg nomination, Huntington Beach, Orange County, at the local level of significance criterion A. That will be pulled from the consent agenda, and it will be heard under discussion and action. And testimony will be taken at that time. So just for the record, the Wintersburg is off the consent calendar and will be heard under discussion and action. Madam Chair, I don't have a very detailed report today. We are mostly focused on filling the several vacancies that we have in our office, and I wanted just to let you all know that we have several. I think there's two now out, and some to come for state historians, some archaeologists, and two supervisor positions for the tax credit architectural review and the archaeology review that are soon to be posted. So if anybody's interested in coming to work in our amazing office, there's lots of opportunity. So I wanted just to let you all know that our social media will we'll keep posting those jobs there. So if all of you can help us flip those and get them out to the public so we can get some great candidates, that'd be very helpful. We're really excited to get these positions filled as soon as we can. Our reviews are business as usual. Still incredibly busy in both the Section 106 and the Public Resources Code 5024 state reviews. So staff is just busy doing this. Nominations are coming in. The Historic Tax Credits Program has finished filling that the space for the allotted money. So we're just operating and keeping up with the workload of the reviews at the moment. And as we round out the year, we will also pick up in January our statewide plan effort. And stay tuned for that. I know we started that at the last commission meeting with a workshop. We just took a little pause to really think about the ability to reach more of a new audience for us. So what does that look like? And then just staff time and getting our vacancies filled. So we will take that back up in January. And with that, I think that's the end of my report, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much for your report. Before we proceed, I'm going to read some general notes on the public participation process for the meeting today. For all wishing to speak today, if you are attending the meeting in person and wish to speak on an item, please fill out a speaker card and hand it to staff at the table at the back of the room. If you are joining virtually and wish to comment on one of the agenda items or during the open comment period, you must be using Zoom or calling in by phone. If you indicated the item for which you wish to speak, you will be called during that time in the order registered. If you did not indicate any item, you may raise your hand during the public comment for the item, and you will be called upon to speak. If you are currently watching the webcast on calspan.org and wish to comment, please register using the link at https://ohp.parks.ca.gov/question mark page PAGE_ID=21372. Go to the bottom of the page and click on via this link under Zoom registration. An email with a link and phone number will be sent to you once you have registered. For each item on discussion and action, the commission will take testimony in the following order. The nominator will have 10 minutes. The property owner or designee will have 10 minutes. The district property owner designee, that's not the case today, but 5 minutes. And then local, state, federal, and tribal governments, 5 minutes. And then members of the public have 3 minutes to speak. Speakers who require a translator will be allocated twice the time otherwise defined. Within this order of commenters, those in the room will be heard from first and then those participating via Zoom or telephone. After registered attendees speak on specific agenda items, anyone else who did not previously register and wishes to speak on that agenda item will be asked to raise their hands. You can call on the telephone and press *9 to raise your hand. Each speaker will be called and allowed to speak. The speaker will then need to unmute themselves. If calling in by phone, you do this by pressing *6. Please note, phone-only speakers will not appear on video. The consent calendar will be taken in a single motion. Once the commission has concluded voting, public comments will be taken. Those speaking on the consent calendar will have 3 minutes to speak. If anyone wishes to speak about an item not on the agenda, they may do so under the public comment period that is later in the meeting. Each speaker will have 3 minutes. I ask all speakers, commissioners, and staff to please state your name for the record before you speak, and if you are speaking on behalf of an organization, please state the organization's name. During public testimony, there will be a timer on the screen. For those calling in by phone, you will be reminded when you have 1 minute remaining. If you experience any technical difficulties, please call or text to area code 805-801-3576 or email IT, that's capital I, capital T, at agpvideo.com, and an IT person will assist you. And a note for the commissioners, if anyone needs to step away, please state that you're leaving so that we can assure that we have a quorum. All right, we're moving on then to item 6 on the agenda, the consent calendar. The commission will consider items on the consent calendar in a single motion without prior public comment. Public comments will be welcome after the vote has concluded. For any person requesting an item be removed from the consent calendar in order to comment before the vote, please complete the speaker registration card and give it to staff at the back of the room. For those joining remotely, please raise your hand to indicate you would like to make a request. If such a request is made, the item will be removed from the consent calendar and heard by the commission at the end of discussion and action. So before we begin, is there any member of the audience who requests a nomination be withdrawn from the consent calendar? Jody, no raised hands?
There are no raised hands, okay. Madam Chair.
Is there any commissioner who requests a nomination be withdrawn from the consent calendar? Okay. Is there any commissioner who wishes to recuse her or himself from hearing the consent calendar? Seeing none. Is there any commissioner who wishes to disclose discussions with any parties on matters listed on the consent calendar? Okay. The Office of Historic Preservation staff now will now present information about each property on the consent calendar, and thanks to William and Amy.
The James C. Dodd and Associates Building is a two-story, 3,025-square-foot office building constructed in 1971, located on X Street, south of Highway 50 in Sacramento, Sacramento County. Designed in the international style, the building has a flat roof and is clad in stucco, wood siding, and concrete block. The west and east facades consist of interior wing walls that extend past the north-facing primary facade and south-facing building rear, forming parapets along the roof. These wing walls feature a repeating hexagonal pattern, a signature pattern designed and used by architect James Dodd for multiple buildings, including the law offices of Nathaniel Cawley and Nancy Reardon, and Capital City's Seventh-day Adventist Church. The primary facade is arranged into four bays with an asymmetrical arrangement at ground floor and a symmetrical upper level. The left bay of the ground level features an entryway to the interior open-air hallway with stairs to the office spaces with a geometric patterned wing wall. The second floor of the primary facade is cantilevered over the ground floor and is clad entirely in stucco, featuring two original aluminum windows in each bay with a prominent elongated mullion positioned between each pair of windows. Each window pair sits above a sloped sill, while the facade slopes upward and back over the windows to reach the roofline. The building has seen some alterations, including vinyl replacement of the aluminum windows on the ground floor, tongue and groove sidings on portions of the ground floor interior, and cast iron security gates. The James Dodd and Associates building is locally significant for its association with architect James Dodd, who used this building as his office during the peak of his professional career, and for its architecture as a significant example of his late international style work. Dodd was the first licensed African-American architect in Sacramento, and he found success undertaking commissions in the region, including many projects for African-American businesses, families, and community organizations. At the time of its construction, Dodd shared this building with fellow property investor Albert H. Hollis, a realtor described as perhaps the first black turnkey developer in the state of California. Born in Texarkana, Texas in 1923, Dodd moved to Chicago in 1943 to attend the University of Wisconsin, but was soon drafted into the Army. Originally hoping to become a pilot, he entered officer school and became a rifle platoon leader. His unit never saw combat, serving in quartermaster and military police roles. After the war, Dodd moved to Oakland and attended UC Berkeley's architecture school, supplementing his GI Bill benefits by working in construction and as a designer for Bay Area architects. He also engaged in civil rights advocacy, including an opinion piece for the Berkeley Gazette about how segregation on the UC Berkeley campus harmed black students. Graduating in 1952, Dodd worked for Bay Area modernist architect Irwin Johnson before being hired by the California State Division of Architecture. In 1953, he moved his family to 13th and X Street in Sacramento, becoming the city's first black architect. His first solo commission, a 1955 apartment complex designed for families on 28th Street, was built in partnership with black developer Albert E. Mitchell. which later became his home when construction of Highway 50 demolished their X Street house. Dodd began working for the firm of Barravetto and Thomas in 1956, where he worked until 1970, while also establishing his own architectural practice in 1960, principally out of his home, first at the aforementioned apartment, then in a home on 60th Street in Meadowview, which he designed himself. Dodd's first major commission in Sacramento was for Shiloh Baptist Church, a black congregation who moved to the neighborhood of Oak Park ahead of the redevelopment of its former location in the West End, completed in 1958. Dodd also appears to have contributed to the design of Kyle's Temple AME Zion, working in conjunction with Sacramento master architect Whitson W. Cox, completed in 1964. During this period, Dodd also served as vice president of the Central Valley chapter of the American Institute of Architects. He also designed custom homes for prominent leaders of Sacramento's African-American community, including Wilmer and Edwina Leon, and the already mentioned Office of Civil Rights Attorney Nathaniel Cawley in the mid-1960s. His experience with educational facilities design at Barravetto and Thomas led him to pursue school design contracts, designing the Bowman School in Auburn, the Maury Avenue School in North Sacramento, and the Jackson School in El Dorado Hills, all featuring mid-century modern design, concrete construction, and geometric forms. Dodd's career accelerated in the late 1960s and early 1970s, when his commissions included the St. John's Apartments in Richmond, the Sacramento Convention Center in conjunction with multiple other firms, including Barravetto, the Herald Wing addition to the Crocker Art Museum, Sacramento Affordable Housing Project's Kennedy Estates, Shiloh Arms, and Oak Park Elderly Housing. It was also during this period that Dodd designed his X Street office. During this period, Dodd also designed a remodel for Sacramento High School, located in the nearby neighborhood of Oak Park, and was project consultant architect for renovation of the historic Colonel Allensworth State Park. Allensworth was a rural farming community established for African Americans escaping the South in 1908 by formerly enslaved Colonel Allen Allensworth. In subsequent years, Dodd continued his architecture practice, including the design of the IRFAB prefabricated panel construction system, work with the Rural Communities Housing Development Corporation in Mendocino County, and many other projects, finally retiring in 1990. He was also very involved in civic organizations, including Sacramento's NAACP chapter. Dodd's work as an architect, an engaged public citizen, left a notable mark on the built environment of Sacramento as part of a generation that broke barriers and advanced the efforts of black professionals to establish themselves in Sacramento. While small in scale, Dodd and Associates represents a distinct style and era of his work as an architect, undertaken during the busiest period of his career, conveying to potential clients and customers his personal modernist sensibilities. The nomination was submitted by a graduate student working with the property owner following surveys undertaken for the City of Sacramento's African American Experience Project, funded in part by an Office of Historic Preservation Certified Local Government grant and a National Trust for Historic Preservation grant. The property owner is in support of the nomination and has sent a letter of support, and two other letters of support have also been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine that James C. Dodd and Associates offices is eligible under criteria B and C in the area of ethnic history, black, and architecture at the local level of significance, with a period of significance of 1971, meeting the requirements of the African Americans in California Multiple Property Document under the context of making a living and the property type of offices of significant persons. The Pence Hotel, located on Mesilla Valley Road in Butte County, is a 2,844-square-foot, timber-framed, two-and-a-half-story residence with a simple rectangular footprint, an overhanging hipped roof in composition shingles, with two first-floor shed extensions facing north and south. The building is clad in timber clapboards with vertical boards at each corner of the building. A moderately pitched gable dormer projects out of the east side. Windows are a mixture of 1-over-1 single-hung wooden windows and vinyl sash replacement windows. The property was moved to its current location in 2006 to prevent its demolition from the other end of the lot. It was rotated 180 degrees to maintain the building's orientation to face the nearest road. The new foundation, dating to 2006, is of poured concrete with local granite facing on the west side. The central chimney was removed in 1975 after an earthquake had damaged it. The south-facing porch and extensions were reconstructed in 2015 following the Secretary of the Interior's standards for restoration. The wood shake roof was replaced in 2015 with a modern composite shingle roof to limit fire hazards, and the north-facing porch was reconstructed in 2016, adding a concrete ramp for ADA access. The building has lost some integrity of location, materials, and design, but retains sufficient historic integrity for listing under Criterion A as the last surviving building of a lost mountain community. There are several other non-contributing resources on the property, including the remains of the Mesilla Valley Schoolhouse, modern well and sheds, and a monument and arch dedicated to the school. The Pence Hotel is significant in the areas of communications and community planning and development, with a period of significance of 1901 to 1912 at the local level of significance for its role as a fourth-class post office serving the Mesilla Valley and for its role as the last surviving building of the Lost Mountain community of Pence. Fourth-class post offices served rural areas and tiny communities, usually operated out of stores and businesses with postmasters appointed by Congress. The advent of rural free delivery, or RFD, programs circa 1912 ended this practice, as fourth-class post offices were consolidated into a smaller number of regional post offices operated under the RFD program. The community of Pence, founded circa 1886, was an important stop on the route from Oroville to the Megalia Ridge mining communities as a rest stop, retail store, and postal carrier. The Pence Hotel meets the requirements of Criteria Consideration B, moved properties, despite being moved approximately a quarter mile. The property retains sufficient integrity for listing under Criterion A, despite loss of integrity of location and some loss of materials and workmanship, because it retains its rural mountain setting on the same lot and with a similar orientation to the road in its new location. It is also the sole surviving property associated with the town of Pence. First established as the Lyon Ranch in 1850 by the partnership of Manoah Pence, William Lyons, Robert Bounds, Alfred Kagi, and John Slocum, the ranch's position on the road leading to the gold mines in Megalia and other mining camps on the Paradise Ridge drove sufficient traffic for a store and restaurant located in a tent. Manoah Pence bought out his partners in 1864, establishing Pence Ranch and filing for a fourth-class post office with himself as postmaster in the new two-story buildings. For reasons not explained in the nomination, the post office department gave the new post office the name Pence, P-E-N-T-Z, even though Mr. Pence's last name was spelled P-E-N-C-E. In the 1870s, the Flea Valley Lumber Company opened a lumber flume just east of Pence, becoming a local employer. Pence expanded into a small settlement with two hotels, feed yard, barber shop, restaurant, saloon, and communal dance hall. And by the 1890s, Pence was connected to Pacific Gas and Electric's hydroelectric power network and appeared on USGS maps. Fire devastated Pence on May 20, 1901, when a hot stove in the original Pence Hotel burned down the building and consumed or damaged many nearby buildings. The current building was constructed by William Wilson and Leon Van Ness using funds for a fire insurance settlement completed in 1901. This new building combined post office and hotel functions under one roof. The owner of the burned hotel, Christian Mortensen, died of erysipelas on June 18th, before the new hotel was completed. Mortensen's widow, Jenny, held the role of postmaster until 1912. Jenny Mortensen died in January 1913. W.J. Miller and W.P. Lynch purchased the ranch, at first stating they would improve the ranch and hotel, but sold it to the Chico Meat Company, who expanded their ranch operation to the Pence Ranch area and probably used the Pence Hotel as lodging for ranch workers. Chico Meat Company leased the building to the Gunn family, who renamed it the Lucky Seven Ranch and rented the former hotel to young couples. The Rural Free Delivery Program centralized small rural post offices and provided door-to-door delivery to remote farms, which meant farmers no longer had to travel all the way to Pence to pick up their mail. While Pence area farmers still traveled there for other reasons, their visits decreased as the Chico Meat Company, owners of the old Pence Ranch, expanded their holdings, and much of the sense of rural community remained in Pence. By the time that Gunn family purchased the property, little remained of this community but the converted hotel. The Gunns removed the central chimney in 1975 after its damage in an earthquake, and then a kitchen fire in 2005 damaged the building, and the Gunns intended to demolish the hotel and replace it with a church. Dale Dunlap intervened and purchased the Pence Hotel, moving it in the following year to prevent its demolition onto land purchased by his daughter, Lynn Bat Moore. Moore has slowly restored the building to its current condition. The nomination was submitted by a consultant working on behalf of the property owner. No public comment has been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine the Pence Hotel eligible for the National Register of Historic Places under Criterion A in the areas communications and community planning and development at the local level of significance with a period of significance of 1901 to 1912 and meeting the requirements of criteria consideration B. The Isis Theater, today named the Ojai Playhouse, is a single-screen movie theater of the Mission Revival design style. It is located in Ojai, Ventura County. Its north-facing front elevation features an espadaña parapet, a signature feature of the building, and its East Ojai Avenue setting for over 100 years. The facade not only fronts the theater, but fronts a once-separate building, now wholly integrated, that houses the theater's concession area and a restaurant. The property possesses one other building, a 1947 dry cleaners that is a non-contributing resource. The Isis Theater is located off the southwest corner of South Signal Street and East Ojai Avenue in Ojai. Ojai, on the account of the beauty and remove of its valley, is considered a resort town. The Isis Theater, with its 1917 facade renovation attributed to the master architectural firm of Mead and Rickwa, is part and parcel of a World War I era mission-styled beautification project for which Ojai is historically identified. Other Mead and Rickwa work, mission-styled works, and additional diminutively scaled single-story buildings surround the Isis Theater. Recently rehabilitated, the Isis Theater is in excellent condition. The property retains integrity of location, setting, design, workmanship, feeling, and association. The interior of the theater, however, received a considerable other rehab. The Isis Theater is eligible under Criterion A, the local level of significance, as a historically significant recreation venue for the city of Ojai, California. Today named the Ojai Playhouse, the property is Ojai's first purpose-built movie theater. The Isis Theater is one of only three store theater property types known to remain in Ventura County. Store theaters, sometimes referred to as Nickelodeons, are the earliest purpose-built motion picture houses of any kind. Additionally, the Isis Theater possesses Criterion A eligibility for its association to community planning and development. Civic booster J.J. Burks purchases the land on which 3 months later the Isis Theater opened, and industrialist Edward Drummond Libby's first announcement of his intention to beautify what was then called a city called Nordhoff both occurred on the same day, April 17, 1914. Both projects are intertwined as Nordhoff became Ojai. The Isis Theater's mission-style facade is a distinctive, recognizable feature of downtown Ojai and exists in purposeful, picturesque composition to the larger World War I era beautification project Libby funded, to which today Ojai is identified. The Isis Theater's period of significance is 1914 to 1945, 1914 being the year of the theater's construction. In 1935, Fred and Lita Hart, theosophists, who changed the name of the venue to the Ojai Theater, sold the property to Bill Swanson so that the property would continue to be moved as a theater. After multiple improvements to the venue during the Great Depression and World War II, and after keeping the theater open into the night to make movies available to locally stationed troops just after the war's end, in December 1945, Swanson sold the property, moved to Malibu, and began construction of Paradise Cove Resort. The Theosophical Society was mentioned earlier. Established in 1874 with a motto of "There is no religion higher than truth," Theosophy was an alternative teaching and spiritual discipline, combative in its approach to world's religions. Theosophy was among the very first Western-based practices wholeheartedly embracing Eastern spiritualist disciplines, including Buddhism. Theosophy has three separate branches, which by the 1920s each had a Southern California headquarters. Of these three, the American section of the Theosophical Society, ADYAR, or India, Theosophical Society, was centered at Crotona, a purchase-built commune in Hollywood's Beechwood Canyon. Crotona's primary purpose was twofold, a place where like-minded students could study theosophy and live its teachings, and as a place made in preparation for the coming world teacher. Theosophical Society leaders had already identified this feature, a young Brahmin boy discovered on an Adyar beach named Jiddu Krishnamurti, who would become a primary Ojai figure. Having lost his mother at age 9, Jiddu's father surrendered Krishnamurti and his brother Nityananda to the Theosophists. Annie Besant, T.S. Adyar's spiritual leader, had him adopted and raised both brothers. Although Crotona Hollywood is in part built for him, and though Krishnamurti as a dashing young man had Hollywood friends, particularly the writers Christopher Isherwood and Aldous Huxley, Krishnamurti was raised in London, and when he arrived in Southern California, it was the clean air and open natural space of Ojai he preferred. In 1924, citing the increased congestion, pollution, and corruption of Hollywood, the Theosophical Society vacated Crotona Hollywood and relocated the entire Crotona colony to Ojai, perceiving Ojai's land as impregnated with occult and psychic influences. Architect Robert Stacy Judd constructed the new Crotona colony west of the town center. Jiddu Krishnamurti, for his part, in 1929, dissolved the Order of the Star of the East that the Theosophical Society had formed around him, declaring in the speech that truth is a pathless land, and walking away from any messianic associations. Nonetheless, until his passing at age 90 in 1986, Krishnamurti lived in Ojai at least part-time of a given year between his travels and lecture tours. Though they continued to own the properties, the Harts ceased running the theater in 1930. During the heart of the Great Depression, the theater had various operators and was also closed for 5 months. In 1933, the Harts turned the business over to Bill Swanson, who operated multiple Southern California movie theaters and had just lost a prior venue in the March 1933 6.4 magnitude Long Beach earthquake. Bill Swanson not only committed to the Ojai Theater through the Great Depression, but made special accommodations for hundreds of troops stationed nearby during World War II. The Ojai Theater was their closest movie theater. From 1942 to 1946, two infantry regiments, the 134th 2nd Battalion and the 174th, followed by the Navy's Acorn Assembly and Training Detachment, were stationed at the Ojai Country Club at different contiguous points over the war and shortly thereafter. The Ojai Theater, which already had one of Ojai Valley's first air conditioning units, became a welcome respite. Swanson kept the Ojai Theater open after hours, deep into the night, according to different accounts, to show movies to the hundreds of troops stationed nearby. To accommodate his troop influx, Swanson added 165 new seats to the theater and converted a vacated doctor's office just west of the theater, the present-day concessions area, into an overflow area. Shortly after the war's end, in December of 1945, Swanson sold the property and moved with his family from Ojai to a Malibu beachfront property. This nomination was submitted by a consultant working on behalf of the property owner. 5 letters of support have been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine the Isis Theater eligible for the National Register of Historic Places under Criterion A in the area of entertainment, recreation, and community planning and development, the local level of significance, with a period of significance of 1912 to 1945.
Located in the Sea Ranch, a master plan community on the coast of unincorporated Sonoma County, Mini Mod Number 3 is a split 3-level residence with a compact 20 by 20 square foot footprint and single steeply sloping shed roof. The 684 square foot residence is located in a densely wooded 0.3 acre lot surrounded by redwood trees. The wood post and beam building is set on a concrete perimeter foundation and is entirely clad in unpainted plywood panels. The residence embodies the local Third Bay tradition of modern architecture with its simple cubic form, unpainted wood exterior finishes, and complex interior volumetric plan. The only fully enclosed room inside the building is the bathroom, and the 3 open interlocking levels create a nuanced and efficient use of space and light. An exterior brick chimney extends along the tallest elevation, the north, and a projecting bay with a shed roof at the upper level of the east elevation breaks the otherwise flat plains that enclose the building. The property retains all aspects of historic integrity. Mini Mod Number 3 is nominated for listing on the National Register of Historic Places at the local level of significance under Criterion C in the area of architecture. The property embodies the principles that informed the early phase of planning and design of residences and other facilities at the Sea Ranch during the mid and late 1960s, realized at a relatively small and economical scale. Mini Mod Number 3 was designed by the architectural firm of Joseph Eschrich and Associates, which was among the first generation of designers hired by Oceanic Properties to develop the environmental design concepts of the Sea Ranch. The residence specifically reflects the contributions of firm principal and long-term Eschrich associate George Homsey. Constructed and completed in 1967, Mini Mod Number 3 was the final of three Mini Mod demonstration houses designed by Eschrich's firm and retains the most intact design and materials of the three. The residence was planned to illustrate a comparatively modest and affordable approach to the Sea Ranch's architectural ethos. Namely, the residence's design incorporated a pared-down palette of local materials, subdued but expressive form echoing the surrounding hillside, and compact floor plan that promoted interaction among interior spaces and the surrounding environs. The building remains an excellent and well-preserved example of Third Bay tradition residential architecture, the Northern Californian regional idiom of architectural modernism that gained broad national influence after it took root at the Sea Ranch in the mid-1960s. The period of significance is 1967, the year of construction. The property is nominated by the property owner. No letters have been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine Mini Mod Number 3 is eligible at the local level of significance under National Register Criterion C with a 1967 period of significance. Claremont Country Club in Oakland occupies approximately 120 acres set amongst the largely residential rolling hills of the Rock Ridge neighborhood, historically known as Rock Ridge, near St. Mary's Cemetery. 17 contributing resources include one site, the golf course, three buildings, clubhouse, manager's cottage, and parking garage, and 13 structures, seven tennis courts, three parking structures, two parking lots, and one reservoir. Six non-contributing resources include four post-period of significance buildings, the golf pro shop, pool house, and two restroom buildings, one building that no longer retains integrity, the Pat O'Hara Tennis Pro Shop on the left, and one post-period of significance structure, the pool. After the first nine holes opened in 1904, with an additional nine holes constructed in 1909, the 18-hole course was redesigned in 1927 by Alistair McKenzie. Following changes between 1927 and 2001, at the request of club leaders and members, a restoration project completed in 2007 by McKenzie specialist Tom Doak restored the course to its 1927 design. As it did in 1927, the course features grassy lawns extending across acres of hilly terrain with sand traps and walking or golf cart driving paths set amongst eucalyptus, redwoods, and streams. The property retains historic integrity with a large majority of historic materials alongside compatible replacement finishes and maintaining historic plans, windows, and site features. Claremont Country Club is nominated for listing on the National Register of Historic Places at the local level of significance under Criterion A in the area of entertainment recreation for its association with the early recreational history of golf on the West Coast, as one of Oakland's earliest and longest-lasting recreational clubs. The club is also nominated under Criterion C in the area of landscape architecture for its design of its golf course by famed golf course architect Alistair McKenzie, and in the area of architecture for the design of its Tudor Revival buildings that are excellent local examples of the style. Established nearby as the Oakland Golf Club in 1897, Claremont Country Club incorporated at the Rock Ridge location in 1903. The period of significance begins in 1904 when the complex opened and continues through 1927 when the golf course was redesigned, 1929 when the existing clubhouse was constructed, circa 1930 when the parking structures and northwest lot were constructed, 1931 when the manager's cottage, shown here, was constructed, and closes in 1977 when the last tennis courts were built. As a property whose construction began over 50 years prior to nomination, and the completion overlaps the 50-year period by a few years or less, Claremont Country Club does not need to meet criteria consideration G, properties that have achieved significance within the last 50 years. The property is nominated by a consultant on behalf of the owner. No letters have been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine Claremont Country Club is eligible at the local level of significance under National Register Criteria A and C with a 1904 to 1977 period of significance and does not need to meet criteria consideration G. Mill Valley City Hall and Fire Station in downtown Mill Valley was built in 1936 in the Tudor Revival style, designed by architects Walter C. Falk and Donald E. Jekyll. The building is complex in plan and massing with a two-story front gabled entry bay, four-story turret, a two-story primary wing, a one-and-a-half-story secondary wing at the southern side, a two-story fire station, and a three-story rear addition. Following the building's completion, it housed the city's fire department, city hall, and the police department with three small fireproof jail cells at the southern secondary wing. At the time of nomination, the building houses Mill Valley City Hall and a small cohort of firefighters in the fire station. While the exterior remains generally unaltered at the primary facade and secondary elevations, the interior was renovated extensively in the 1970s, and an addition was constructed to the rear elevation in 1978. The property retains all aspects of historic integrity and is in good condition, with the majority of its character-defining features intact. The property is nominated for listing on the National Register of Historic Places at the local level of significance under Criterion A in the area of politics government as an important institutional property associated with civic and cultural values emblematic of Mill Valley's Depression-era patterns of development during a period of institutional growth spurred by New Deal-era federal programs in the wake of the Great Depression and a period of reconstruction following Mill Valley's Great Fire of 1929. The property was constructed with funding provided by the Public Works Administration and serves as a symbol of the collective effort and collaboration undertaken by Mill Valley citizens during a prolonged period of economic hardship. Designed by local architects Falk and Jekyll, the property is also nominated for listing at the local level of significance under Criterion C in the area of architecture as an excellent local example of an institutional building in the Tudor Revival style. The building features high style motifs, including cross-gabled, steeply pitched roof forms, a prominent turret, half timbering, clinker brick veneer, and door openings with Tudor arches. The period of significance is 1936 to 1943, from construction in 1936 through the sunset of the New Deal era Federal Public Works Program in 1943, the culmination of a period of federally funded civic development in Mill Valley. The property is nominated by a consultant on behalf of the owner. No letters have been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine Mill Valley City Hall and Fire Station is eligible at the local level of significance under National Register Criteria A and C with a 1936 to 1943 period of significance. Chautauqua Hall is a one-story social hall built in 1881 by the Pacific Improvement Company, located in downtown Pacific Grove. The building was constructed with local redwood materials and reflects the rusticity of early development in Pacific Grove. It does not otherwise represent any specific architectural style. The building was first used as a Methodist church and has had many subsequent uses, including as a schoolhouse, storage facility, assembly hall for the Chautauqua movement, gymnasium, and multipurpose social hall. Owned by the City of Pacific Grove, Chautauqua Hall has been minimally altered apart from the expansion of a rear addition and the reconstruction of the belfry in 1991. Significant features of Chautauqua Hall include its simple gabled massing, large window bays with original multi-light double-hung wood sash windows, board and batten redwood siding, and wood truss ceiling. The property retains all aspects of historic integrity. Chautauqua Hall is nominated for listing on the National Register of Historic Places at the local level of significance under Criterion A in the area of social history as a civic and public assembly building symbolic of religious and cultural affiliations tied to Pacific Grove's earliest period of development by the Pacific Improvement Company. Chautauqua Hall also represents the legacy of the Chautauqua movement in Pacific Grove and its association with Pacific Grove's origin as a retreat town. Under Criterion C in the area of architecture, Chautauqua Hall is significant as an early and rare example of rustic design in Pacific Grove, expressed through its use of redwood board and batten siding, multi-light wood sash windows, and post and beam construction methods with an exposed truss ceiling. The 1881 to 1914 period of significance opens the year of construction and closes when the use of Chautauqua Hall transitioned from its original use as an assembly hall for Chautauqua lectures and religious services to a recreational gymnasium. As a former religious facility, no longer used for that purpose, and significant under another historical theme, the property meets criteria consideration A, religious properties. As a property moved from one location on its original parcel to another location on the property, even after the period of significance, Chautauqua Hall meets criteria consideration B, moved properties. The property is nominated by a consultant on behalf of the owner. No letters have been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine Chautauqua Hall is eligible at the local level of significance under National Register Criteria A and C with an 1881 to 1914 period of significance and meets criteria considerations A and B. Constructed in 1936 in downtown Palm Springs, Plaza Theater was designed by architect Harry J. Williams. The building is an excellent example of a 1930s Spanish colonial revival atmospheric theater and is associated with the early 20th century commercial development of Palm Springs. It embodies the significant features of the style and property type, including its complex massing, clay tile hipped roof, painted concrete exterior walls, arched fenestration, steel windows, and wood paneled primary doors at the exterior, and its double-height auditorium with coved ceiling, Spanish-themed sidewalls, raised stage and sloped seating, and main entry foyer at the interior. The approximately 15,110 square foot concrete building has undergone few alterations since its original construction and retains all aspects of historic integrity. The building is undergoing rehabilitation for use as a performing arts and motion picture theater. Originally owned and operated by prominent theater impresario Earl Strebe, Plaza Theater is nominated for listing on the National Register of Historic Places at the local level under Criterion A in the area of entertainment recreation for its association with the early 20th century commercial development of Palm Springs and under Criterion C in the area of architecture as a building that embodies the distinctive characteristics of the Spanish colonial revival style and the early commercial movie theater property type, with its exterior entrance plaza and atmospheric auditorium. The period of significance is 1936 to 1955, beginning with the year the theater opened and encompassing its height in use as a venue for star-studded charity events and benefit shows, live theater and variety show performances, and several live audience radio show recordings. The Plaza Theater is nominated by a consultant on behalf of the property owner. The Historic Preservation Certification Application Part 2, Description of Rehabilitation, was conditionally approved in August 2024. Rehabilitation is expected to be completed fall 2025, with the opening ceremony scheduled for November 21st. No letters have been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine the Plaza Theater is eligible at the local level of significance under National Register Criteria A and C with a 1936 to 1955 period of significance. The Army and Navy YMCA is located on the west side of South Beacon Street in the Vinegar Hill Historic Preservation Overlay Zone in the San Pedro community of the City of Los Angeles. The parcel comprises 9 of the 10 lots on the city block bounded by South Beacon Street on the east, South Palos Verdes Street on the west, West 9th Street on the north, and West 10th Street on the south. The lot at the southwest corner of the block is occupied by two multifamily residential buildings. The YMCA overlooks the main channel of the Port of Los Angeles to the east. Designed in the Mediterranean Revival style by Los Angeles architects J. Rogers and Stevens and constructed in 1926, the building has a rectangular plan around a central courtyard. 5 stories in height over a raised basement of concrete and brick masonry construction, the building has a hipped roof with clay barrel tile roofing and bracketed metal eaves. The exterior walls are finished in smooth cement plaster and are articulated in the classical manner into a base, middle, and top, with a molded water table and continuous sill courses under the second and fifth story windows. The building's corners are articulated with decorative cast stone coins. The building exhibits exemplary character-defining features of the Mediterranean Revival style, including its rectilinear massing, plaster walls with applied cast stone ornament, hipped roof with wide eaves and clay tile roofing, paneled wood doors, wood sash windows, and decorative tile and metalwork, and retains all aspects of historic integrity. The property is nominated for listing on the National Register of Historic Places at the local level of significance under Criterion A in the areas of social history and military for its association with the expansion of the Young Men's Christian Association throughout the United States in the post-World War I era, with the growth of the organization's services targeted to military personnel, and with the growing importance of San Pedro as a military base and naval port between the two world wars. Under Criterion C, at the local level of significance in the area of architecture, the building is significant as a prominent and exceptional example of the YMCA building type developed in the early 20th century and of Mediterranean Revival architecture applied to an institutional building. Its design is the product of an association among 3 prominent Southern California architects of the 1920s, Clarence Lee Jay of Pasadena and Lincoln Rogers and Frank W. Stevenson of San Diego. The period of significance is 1926 to 1947, from completion of construction until the building was converted to civilian use. Because of its large size, quality design, and prominent location on the main channel of the Port of Los Angeles, the building remains a strong visual architectural landmark of San Pedro. The Army and Navy YMCA was formally determined eligible for listing in the National Register by consensus through Section 106 review in 1994, and again in 2019 by approval of the Historic Preservation Certification Application Part 1, Evaluation of Significance. The rehabilitation is complete, and the HPCA Part 3, Request for Certification of Completed Work, was signed July 8, 2025. The Army and Navy YMCA is nominated by a consultant on behalf of the property owner. No letters have been received. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine the Army and Navy YMCA is eligible at the local level of significance under National Register Criteria A and C with a 1926 to 1947 period of significance. 3 Princes Surf Site is located at the San Lorenzo River mouth, a surf break in Santa Cruz. The break is formed by the confluence of the San Lorenzo River and the northern water's edge and shoreline of Monterey Bay. The confluence is bounded in part to the west by Santa Cruz Main Beach and to the east by Seabright State Beach. Wave formation at the San Lorenzo River mouth is dependent upon the presence of the sandbar, which develops most consistently during the winter months. When the sandbar is present, the wave peak starts approximately a quarter of a mile offshore and peels in both directions, creating an ideal wave for surfing. When the sandbar is present at low tide, the break can produce waves with pronounced tubes. The surf break is a natural occurrence influenced by the sandbar that develops at the river mouth of the San Lorenzo River. Weather conditions in the Santa Cruz Mountains affect the composition and size of the sandbar, making it a primary feature in the winter months due to precipitation in the mountains. The sandbar forms a delta shape, causing the waves to run in both directions along the sand in a peeling fashion. The sandbar can develop in a way that abruptly changes the slope of the seabed, making the crest of incoming waves move faster than the base of the wave. This interaction pushes the peak of the wave to curl, forming a tube or barrel. These dramatic tubes are sought after as a rare quality of wave in the Santa Cruz area. Three Princes Surf Site at the San Lorenzo River mouth was the original location that surfing, as practiced by Native Hawaiian peoples standing on a wooden board, was introduced to the continental United States in July 1885. Surfing caught on in Santa Cruz and has become strongly associated with the city and region. Santa Cruz has been designated as one of the most unique surf locations in the world, based in part on this history. Three Princes Surf Site is nominated under California Historical Landmark Criterion 2 for its association with individuals having a profound influence on the history of California. The period of significance is 1885. The property is nominated by California State Parks with the consent and consultation of the co-owner, the City of Santa Cruz. The city's letter of support is on file. An additional letter of support was received from the County of Santa Cruz. Staff supports the nomination as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine that for its association with individuals having a profound influence on the history of California, Three Princes Surf Site meets the criteria for designation as a California Historical Landmark. This concludes the consent calendar.
Thank you, Amy and William, for your detailed presentations. Okay, now the motion is with the commission. Is there a motion to approve the consent calendar?
A motion to approve the consent calendar as written.
And do we have a second?
I'll second that.
All right. We have a motion by Commissioner Cerullo and a second by Commissioner Payton to approve the consent calendar. I'm sorry. Yeah. Commissioner Villanueva. I did not hear that. Are we okay? All right. Tara, can we please have the roll call?
Yes. Commissioner Adams.
Aye.
Commissioner Payton.
Yes.
Commissioner Cerullo.
Aye.
Commissioner Villanueva.
Aye.
Chairperson Hansen.
Aye.
Thank you. The motion carries 500.
Okay. Congratulations to all the all of the preparers of the nomination as well as the property owners. Are there any commissioners who wish to speak on one or more items, properties just approved on the consent calendar?
I could start. I was trying to consolidate my notes on the nominations because I had so many interesting things that I caught. There's not a whole lot of archaeology to talk about, but I could say that there were a couple of patterns that came up with such a diverse collection of nominations for this quarter. The two patterns that I saw that were just really interesting to read about was the multi-use of some of these properties, whether it be the Pence Hotel serving as the community building, and working through rural free delivery programs to the Chautauqua Hall, which was a church and a schoolhouse and a storage facility, and then you had something, the Mill Valley City Hall and fire station. The multi-use of some of these structures meant that the community relied on it for more than one thing, and I thought that was a neat way of using some of these buildings over time as original uses might have become less important. And then there was also a sense of advocacy in some of these buildings with James Dodd and the African-American experience coming out of that building, as well as the start of the mini-mod, which looked like the beginning of the tiny house movement, and how Commissioner Adams and I would probably have to go halvesies on something that small on the Sonoma coast, which is a nice place to be if you can afford it. But just really happy with the diverse collection of nominations, and it was a really fun read to go through them.
I concur. Yeah. Other commissioners? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, this was a good group of nominations, though admittedly I've only had one other group, so I don't have a huge amount to compare it to. But in particular, the Plaza Theater is one that I'm somewhat familiar with, and I'm really enjoyed the fact that the building itself, we didn't just look at a building, we actually looked at an ensemble of an urban place that was in front of the building as well, the courtyard that's created, and that actually is a really wonderful thing about that building, I think. So just, that's great.
Thank you. Commissioner Villanueva.
Yeah, I think to echo what has been said so far, I'm always amazed at the diversity of historically significant properties that exist in the state of California. And for me, as an archaeologist, and I think Adam, maybe Commissioner Adam, Shiro was sort of saying the same thing here, but as archaeologists, we work with historical resources or properties that are in ruins or in ground. And to see and to envy sometimes the built environment and the incredible architectural resources that we have here in the state, and how even though, for example, in the Pence case, Pence Hotel and Post Office case, it was moved, it still embodied the stories of that building. And for me, I keep coming back to that as a commissioner. And the longer I serve, the more properties that I evaluate, the more nominations that I see come across my desk, I'm more and more impressed by what we have in the state of California and how varied it could be looked at from either the stories that are part of what, for example, Dodd and Associates, I mean, historically significant event or events, to the fact that these buildings themselves have an aesthetic value that pleases us today. And I think for historic preservation and the reason that this commission exists is to acknowledge that, is to acknowledge what we have in the state of California and how varied we could look at these properties. Someone might not know the stories but are inspired by the lines of a building. Somebody might not understand what the lines of a building mean but are inspired by the potential or the stories that took place there. And for me, that's why we exist. And so living as an archaeologist and viewing the world of historic preservation of historical resources as an archaeologist, I've come to appreciate more and more what the built environment can say for us in future generations and how we can interact with these resources by literally walking by and taking a glance. And I think every Californian should take a glance to see the properties that are out there. What is it, to smell the roses, take time to smell the roses or what have you. I'm bad at those things. I think that's what I get out of this, is that the importance that we all understand and we teach the future generations of kids out there that, wow, you're surrounded by this incredibly significant beauty. And this commission plays a role in that. And you, the audience, and the citizens of the state of California play a role in that. So, yes, I was once again, to put it in common terms, blown away by what we saw today.
Any other comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't going to speak, but I did have to comment that the diversity of what comes before us is always amazing, and in this session, I've learned a new disease that the gentleman from the Pence Hotel died of. I'm not going to pretend to pronounce it, and also the religion regarding the Ojai Theater, so it is fascinating.
Okay, just to wrap up the comments, and maybe to start with Commissioner Cerrero's comments about the multi-uses of the properties. I think that it's also reflected in the depth of the nominations themselves and how what the range of the areas of significance represented by the resources. I should have made a list of those as we were going along, but I did note that of the 10 properties, 8 were significant also under Criterion A, for various reasons, and one also under Criterion B. And I think the quality of the nominations is certainly has a lot to do with the preparers of the nominations themselves, but I also think it's the skill of the staff helping with the nominations, William and Amy, for ferreting out all of the significance of the properties. And even under Criterion C, properties were significant for architecture, but also for building typologies. So I was just very impressed with this, as well as being intrigued and interested in the various subject matters and resources themselves. I did want to just give a note to the Plaza Theater as a person from Palm Springs. The rehabilitation of that building was a true labor of community love going on for many years, and I think the nomination was part of the process of the rehabilitation, and it's a nice addition to the city's roster of properties listed in the National Register. And Julie, I think you had some comments as well.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to note that every one of the nominations is at the local level of significance. And I think that I was on vacation yesterday speaking to the Urban Land Institute Sustainability Council, for which I am now no longer a fellow, but they had asked me to come and spend a couple years with them to fill in the gaps about cultural heritage and historic preservation and development and urban planning. And one of the things I said yesterday that this really sort of emphasizes is that it's really about local communities and what they value, the places that they live, work, and love, and how we can help celebrate and commemorate that history as our communities see fit. And I just wanted to, I would be remiss about not saying that my hometown of Mill Valley is on the agenda. And what's so lovely about it, in addition to being an amazing building, is that it's an active community asset. It is not just the fire station and it's not just the city hall, but it is a community asset. Everybody walks by it. If you come for the 4th of July, there's an amazing pancake breakfast in front of it, and everything in between. And so it just reminds me, and these local designations, that these aren't just buildings that are monopoly things that are set in stone and stoic and just something to look at and kind of be curious about, that they're places that we actively use and continue to add history to. And I think that's the beauty of the list that we see today. And I just wanted to congratulate my town. I know they're going to talk, but they're so excited. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next we are going to hear from members of the public. For each nomination, I will be calling on people who are present here first in the order that the items were on the consent calendar. Virtual speakers will be called on after those here in person in the order that they registered. And then we will then ask for anyone else who wants to speak to raise their hand. And each speaker has 3 minutes. And please step up to the podium and state your name and, if relevant, your affiliation. So first we have Sean DeCourcy for Dodd & Associates.
There we go. Thank you, Chair, members of the Commission, Office of Historic Preservation staff, and members of the public. Again, my name is Sean DeCourcy. I am the Preservation Director for the City of Sacramento, and I'm speaking on behalf of the City and our Preservation Commission in strong support of the nomination of the Dodd & Associates Office to the National Register of Historic Places. In August, the City listed this property on the Sacramento Register as part of our African American Experience Project. This was a project funded by the National Trust for Historic Preservation African American Cultural Heritage Action Fund. Building on the work, the California Office of Historic Preservation funded this nomination through an underrepresented communities grant that enabled Groundwork Historic Preservation consultants to prepare this excellent nomination. The nomination is an important recognition of James C. Dodd, a groundbreaking designer, civic leader, and Sacramento's first African-American architect. Mr. Dodd was responsible for many community landmarks, including the Shiloh Baptist Church, which staff showed a photograph of. It was one of the most historically and socially significant Black institutions in Sacramento. Dodd's career mattered not just for the buildings he designed, but for the legacy he forged at a time when Black architects were profoundly underrepresented in the profession. For these reasons, the City of Sacramento enthusiastically supports this nomination. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Next, we have Etienne Lefebvre, also for Dodd & Associates.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Etienne Lefebvre. I'm an Associate Cultural Resources Historian for Groundwork Preservation. And I was selected by the California Preservation Foundation to prepare the Dodd & Associates Office's nomination in support of their under-recognized California grant program. This program supports a student in the preservation field in the nomination of a historic site that has been statistically underrepresented in local, state, and national registers, such as sites in communities of color, working-class neighborhoods, immigrant enclaves, and other cultural landmarks. As Sean said, this nomination was also done in collaboration with the City of Sacramento to support the nomination of a site in their 2023 African American Experience Project. The nomination of Dodd's offices to the National Register reflect the significant physical and cultural legacy he left on Sacramento's landscape, especially within the Black community. And this nomination could not have been done without the support of CPF, the City of Sacramento's proactive preservation office, and the property owners, who are very supportive and excited for the nomination. So thank you again to everyone who supported this nomination, and I hear if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Etienne. Sorry for mispronouncing your last name. Next, we have Daniel Paul for the Isis Theater.
All right. Good morning, commissioners. I'm Daniel Paul, architectural historian. I was the consultant who prepared the Isis Theater National Register of Historic Places landmark nomination. It's nice to come up here and not have to do a PowerPoint for something really controversial for a change, like some of my past ones. So I just want to say a couple of thank yous. I would like to thank William Berg for always being so helpful for all of these nominations, including this one. So thank you so much, William. David Berger, who not only brought me on to do this, but has lovingly put so much energy and resources into what is known today as the Ojai Playhouse over the last few years, and others in the community. It was mentioned that there were five letters of support, Craig Walker and the Alawar family, who really kept this theater going at a time when it was kind of, you know, when things were a little bit different in the 80s and 90s and through the early aughts. It survived a major flood. One thing that I found really fascinating about the Isis Theater is the date of April 17th, 1914. On that day, this was a day when Edward Drummond Libby, founder of Libby Owens Fort Glass, and became an Ojai booster. There was a meeting of 87 local citizens who decided to improve the city. And this is where the Meet in Requa project began, at that very meeting. Before that, the town was known as Nordhoff. On that very same day, on that very same morning, J.J. Burke, another local booster, purchased the lot that became the Isis Theater. He had planned to do this in coordination with this meeting. So from the moment Nordhoff became Ojai, the Isis Theater was part and parcel of that transformation, and it is part and parcel of Ojai today. It is one of only three store theaters left in Ventura County. And surprisingly enough, this is only the fourth National Register nomination for the city of Ojai. So, speaking for David Berger, I know he's would be very happy about this, and we're all very honored, and I'm thankful for all the community support, and thank you for all of your support of the commission and of staff. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We have a fourth speaker, Lisa Newman, for the city of Mill Valley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the commission, and also staff. We had the privilege of working with Amy Crane. I also had the great privilege of working in the beautiful Mill Valley City Hall, where I served as senior planner. And a lot of my work focused on historic preservation programs and projects. And one of the most engaging programs involved working with the community, with the Mill Valley Historical Society, and Page and Turnbull to develop the historic context statement and historic resources inventory for Mill Valley. And during that period, I realized that the Outdoor Art Club, a beautiful private women's club adjacent to City Hall, is the only structure in Mill Valley listed on the Federal Register of Historic Places. And so, in addition, with my work on a small renovation for City Hall and a more significant renovation of the former train and bus depot in downtown Mill Valley, which involved preparation of historic resource evaluations, it made it clear to me that they were prominent historic resources deserving of state and federal listing. Now retired, I serve on the Mill Valley Historical Society Board, and where I've encouraged the board to use these important tools, the Historic Context Statement and Resources Inventory, for new historic preservation programs and projects. And so this year, in the spirit of the 125th anniversary of Mill Valley's incorporation, and the wonderful celebration that the city hosted on its behalf, the Historical Society Board formed a partnership with the City of Mill Valley to prepare the application for formally listing City Hall. And this was supported by the expert architectural historians Page and Turnbull. So on behalf of the Historical Society, we are really, really excited and grateful for the Commission's review and support of the city's application. And we believe that this community-city partnership is a good model that can continue for future historic research and preservation projects just like this one. So thank you very much.
Thank you. That was the end of the submitted speaker cards. I just want to check before we go to phone calls. Does anybody else in the room wish to speak on an item or more, one or more items on the consent calendar? Please. Yes. Do we need a speaker slip or afterwards?
Can you fill a speaker slip when you're finished?
When you're finished,
thank you.
Since I don't have your name.
I'm Stephen Burke. I'm the mayor of Mill Valley, California.
Okay.
And on behalf of our city council and our staff, I want to thank the commission and the superb staff that supported this application, as well as reading it so beautifully. You have a bright future in broadcasting, both of you. As Lisa touched on, this was a public-private partnership, which is something Mill Valley is very proud of, how we work with our nonprofits, and the Historical Society has been an amazing partner. They came to us in January with this idea, and Lisa, together with the president, Nancy Emerson, and our director of planning, Patrick Kelly, put their heads together to figure out how to do this, and then Page and Turnbull did what they do so well. In early December, we're going to seal a time capsule at the end of our 125th anniversary celebration year with messages to the future in the year 2100, and I will be very proud to include this in that time capsule. Nice. So thank you very, very much for your support.
Thank you.
Can I just say one thing?
Sure.
So I have the occasion to visit Mill Valley once a year on the Saturday after Thanksgiving because my cousin runs a race called the Quad Dipsy, which is an insane thing to do, if you know it, but she does. And I was surprised to see the application because I assumed that that building would have been designated a long time ago. So I was surprised to see that you were making an application for that. It's obviously very beautiful, but the thing is, when I first went to Mill Valley, I'm originally from the other side of the country, and when I first visited, I couldn't believe this place existed. And I was surprised, and I said, wow, do people know about this place? It's really nice. I was informed that people do, in fact, know about Mill Valley, but it's a special place you have there, so...
Well, thank you very much, and if you want to look me up, I'll give you my card, and I'll give you a tour of the City Hall.
Thank you. That
would
be
great. While
your
cousin is suffering on the
day. Oh, God, yeah. Okay, thank you.
The oldest road race in America, by the way.
Also on the National Register, the Dipsy Trail, made by this commission.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Thank you very much.
You got to do it four times, though, for the Quad Dipsy, so it's...
But it only has to be put on once.
All right, next we're going to have Jody call on virtual speakers.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. For everyone who has registered to speak on the consent items, I will be calling on you in the order of the consent calendar. So first off, we have Mr. Jonathan Haber. Mr. Haber, it shows that you've registered about three times in here, so I'm going to pick one of them and allow you to speak, if you would unmute yourself. Okay. I guess I picked the wrong one. Well, if you would unmute yourself, please, Mr. Haber. You can speak. You've been allowed to speak.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can. You have 3 minutes.
Great, thank you. I just wanted to repeat some of the other comments and also thank the commission for approving this wonderful slate of nominations. I remember holding a CPF workshop at the Mill Valley City Hall, and it is and will continue to be such a wonderful community resource, so I was pleased to see that. I'm specifically speaking on behalf of the California Preservation Foundation, and we just wanted to express our deep gratitude and appreciation to the staff of the OHP and also the commission for approving the nomination of the James C. Dodd Associates offices. It's a listing that's especially meaningful to us because it represents the first completed nomination through our under-recognized California program. And we know that this effort has been a long time in the making, and we just helped it get through the finish line. But your action today affirms that the stories of people like James Dodd matter, and that the architecture of inclusion and perseverance and creativity is worthy of protection. And just wanted to thank you for everything you've done to help make this possible. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Haber. Next up, we will have A.R. Fowler. I am allowing you to speak. If you would unmute yourself. Hold on. You are unmuted, A.R. Fowler.
Hello?
Yes, okay, we can hear you. You have 3 minutes.
Good day to you. Good day to you all. I'm A.R. Fowler. I'm the consultant and author for the nomination of the Pence Hotel. I'm delighted to hear the nomination has been adopted, and the owner, Lynn Batmore, will be beyond enthused. She's been really, really excited to try and get this little surviving tiny piece of Butte County history recognized with all the protections that can come with an NRHP listing. As she has been slowly working on preserving and trying to restore this little piece of Butte over past decade and a half at this point, because her goal is to establish a little museum dedicated to the long lost community of Pence and even the little surrounding bits and pieces of this particular area of Butte County. And I wasn't very intrigued by it at first, but properties have a way of digging their nails and claws into us as we dive deeper and deeper into them and find out all the hidden truths they have, all these little long forgotten aspects they have that show that these were once flourishing places of community that over time either contracted or fell apart. Learning about the fourth class post office and the effect on the creation of these tiny communities and even the demise was really a fascinating just exploration for me, because in Butte County, all these names like, say, Pence or Mountain House, these are all just names, they're placeholders. There's almost no history left to really tie them together. But when you research, when you dig back in, you go, oh, this was once a fourth class post office. This was once the site of a tiny little community with its own people. And then with the rise of rural free delivery, it all just disintegrated and fell apart. And over time, there's almost none of these places left in Butte County. The Pence Hotel was pretty much the only other surviving one aside from the Inskip Hotel. Now, Butte County did have one tiny community survive, and it was even listed on the NRHP. It was the Mountain House Historic District, but sadly in 2021, the raging inferno that was the Dixie Fire utterly destroyed it entirely. So I'm hoping that with the Pence Hotel's nomination, that this helps reignite a bit of passion by the people to go and learn more about these lost communities to help form the entire county. I wanted to end this off by saying, I want to thank the chair and community for both their time and work at expanding the preservation and recognition of California's history. And I also want to thank the amazing people at the Office of Historic Preservation for their hard work at expanding upon and preserving California's history for us all to enjoy. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mr. Fowler. Next up, we will have Nika Faulkner. Nika Faulkner, I'm allowing you to speak. If you would unmute yourself, you have 3 minutes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Nika Faulkner from Heritage Consulting Group. I'm representing the leadership and membership of Claremont Country Club. And we just wanted to express our support and excitement regarding this nomination and our gratitude to Amy Crane and the Office of Historic Preservation for working with us and collaborating just to make this nomination the best it could possibly be. Claremont is undeniably a significant place that has continuously served its community since the early 20th century. And we hope that as it continues to do that, that it will be formally honored through the National Register as one of Alistair Mackenzie's great works and one of the predominant historic recreational sites in the Bay Area. Claremont's role in the history of golf as it was popularized in the United States and in landscape design history and the history of the country clubs and recreation generally in our country is undoubtedly something that deserves celebration and recognition. So on behalf of Claremont, thank you once again to Amy and the commissioners. We really appreciate your time and all the work that you do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Faulkner. Next up, we have Patrick Kelly. Mr. Kelly, I am allowing you to speak. If you would unmute yourself, you have 3 minutes.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Hansen, members of the commission. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today regarding the nomination of Mill Valley City Hall and Fire Station. The city of Mill Valley is well known for its beautiful natural setting, historic downtown, and strong sense of community character. Our city's pride in its historic civic and cultural buildings was recognized in Mill Valley's General Plan 2040, which established policies leading to the preparation of the Mill Valley Historic Context Statement and Historic Resources Inventory, both adopted in 2021 that Lisa Newman touched on. Mill Valley City Hall is an architectural gem in the heart of our downtown where civic, cultural, and commercial life come together within a walkable and vibrant setting. The City Council, City Manager, and staff are grateful to receive the State Historical Resources Commission's support for our application to list City Hall and Fire Station on the California Register of Historical Resources and for recommending its inclusion on the National Register of Historic Places. We extend our sincere thank you to the Commission and staff for their thoughtful review of our application and to Page and Turnbull for their expertise and professional assistance in preparing this important nomination. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Next up, we have Andrew Shimizu. Mr. Shimizu, I am going to allow you to speak. If you would unmute yourself. Mr. Shimizu, if you can unmute yourself. Okay, we will come back and try again. Hold on. Next up, we have Barney Langner. Mr. Langner, I'm going to allow you to speak. If you would unmute yourself.
Ma'am, I really didn't intend to speak. I hit the wrong button, so I apologize.
Okay, not a problem. Thank you. Chair Hansen, that's everyone who has registered. Is there anyone else online who would like to speak to any of the consent calendar items? Please raise your hand. There are no hands raised, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Jody. Does anybody need a break, or should we just keep going? I think staff has requested 10 minutes. 10 minutes? So we will come back at
19.
Yeah. Sorry, we can't add. Had to put a 1 on 09 becomes 19. 12:19. Is everyone here that needs to be?
Quorum.
Oh, yes. There he is.
Okay. All right. We're reconvening at 12:19, and we're moving on to discussion and action. We have one discussion and action item that was removed from the consent calendar due to the property owner's opposition to the nomination. Because of this, the nomination is now a request for determination. Testimony will be taken from those who wish to speak on the item. Following this, the public comment period will close and the commission will deliberate. Before we proceed, is there any commissioner who wishes to recuse themselves from hearing the discussion item? Is there any commissioner who wishes to disclose discussions with any parties regarding the discussion item? Okay. Amy? Maybe we please have the presentation for Wintersburg.
It's not up. Okay. Wintersburg is a historic district on approximately 4.5 acres in Huntington Beach, representing the surviving remnant of the former farming community of Wintersburg, historically associated with Japanese settlement in the area in the early 20th century and after World War II. Four contributing buildings include the Spanish Colonial Revival-style Japanese Presbyterian Church of Wintersburg, constructed in 1934, and three buildings associated with the C.M. Furuta Farm that previously occupied the property, the craftsman-style Furuta House No. 1 and adjacent Furuta Barn, both constructed in 1912, and the minimal traditional style Furuta House No. 2, constructed in 1947. The non-contributing structure is a post-period of significance utilitarian steel shed, constructed circa 1990. Although the buildings are in poor condition, in particular Furuta House No. 1 and the barn, they collectively retain sufficient character-defining features from the period of significance to convey their association with Japanese settlement in Orange County. The district meets the integrity thresholds established in the Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in California Multiple Property Submission for resources associated with migration and community formation. Due to the rarity of these resources, a historic district may be as small as a few buildings in proximity to each other, and retention of location, feeling, association, and sometimes setting may be more important than design, workmanship, and materials to convey significance. The district's extant buildings represent the sole remnants of the former community of Wintersburg, and individually and collectively retain integrity of location, feeling, and association. In addition, although compromised, the buildings also retain integrity of design, workmanship, and materials. The district retains its original rural character, although there are no visible remnant site or landscape features associated with the former agricultural uses of the property, and the wider setting surrounding the property was transformed in the period after World War II. Wintersburg is nominated for listing on the National Register of Historic Places under Criterion A at the local level of significance in the areas of ethnic heritage, Asian, Japanese, and agriculture for its association with a thriving agricultural community with a significant concentration of Japanese residents in the early decades of the 20th century. The growth of the local Japanese community led to the foundation of the Japanese Presbyterian Mission in 1904, which by the 1930s had become a full-fledged congregation and was officially renamed the Japanese Presbyterian Church. It remained a spiritual and social center of the community until the church relocated to Garden Grove in 1965. The Wintersburg community also established other religious, commercial, and civic organizations with the support of the mission or fellow congregants. The Asari Market, later the Tashima Market, opened by Tsurumatsu Asari in 1907, was the first Japanese market in Wintersburg. Asari was a crop and goldfish farmer in Wintersburg, a member of Orange County's first Buddhist church, and a founding supporter of the Wintersburg Presbyterian Mission, signing the 1904 prospectus for the mission effort. Gunjiro Tashima, who started as a stock boy in the market, bought the commercial enterprise from Asari around 1915. The second story of the Tashima Market building was used as a community meeting place until the Tashimas moved their market to Garden Grove before World War II. A portion of the mission land was sold to Charles Mitsuji Furuta prior to the passage of the 1913 Alien Land Act, making Furuta one of the few Issei to own property in California. Furuta was a leading figure in the mission and the community, and his farm was a social and cultural hub in Wintersburg before the Second World War. As the surviving remnant of the town of Wintersburg, the property meets the registration requirements for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in California, 1850 to 1965, in the context of migration and community formation. The period of significance begins in 1908, when land was purchased to construct the Japanese Presbyterian Mission's first permanent facilities. Although many of the town's residents returned after incarceration, in the decades after World War II, the Japanese-American population dispersed throughout the region. In 1957, Wintersburg was annexed by the city of Huntington Beach, and the agricultural character of the area was replaced with suburban development. In 1965, the Japanese Presbyterian Church relocated to Garden Grove, marking the end of the period of significance, as Wintersburg was no longer a significant hub for Japanese-American life and culture in Orange County. Wintersburg is nominated by a consultant on behalf of a nonprofit advocacy organization. The district includes five resources and has a single property owner. A letter of objection from the owner was received October 30, 2025. Two letters of support have been received. Staff supports the request for determination of eligibility as written and recommends the State Historical Resources Commission determine Wintersburg is eligible at the local level of significance under National Register Criterion A with a 1908 to 1965 period of significance and meets the registration requirements for Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in California, 1850 to 1995, in the context of migration and community formation. This concludes the summary.
Thank you, Amy. We will now hear comments on this item in the following order. The nominator has 10 minutes, the property owner or designee, 10 minutes, the governmental representatives, 5 minutes, and then the general public, 3 minutes. So the nominator is online. Is that correct?
Good afternoon. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Ernie Nishi. I am the president of Historic Wintersburg Conservancy, and I thank the chair, Hansen, and the commissioners for allowing me to speak on this very important issue. This application culminates 29 years of effort, commencing in 1996 when the city of Huntington Beach designated Historic Wintersburg as a local landmark in its Historic Resources Cultural element of the general plan. It is a major accomplishment for us to get here. It's actually taken several different leaders and several different persons. I am just the latest in the particular group. How did I get involved? 33 years ago, I was married at this church called Wintersburg. It's a thriving place in Orange County. It's the center of a lot of Japanese American culture in Orange County. And I was wondering, why does this property have a non-Asian name? And I started to peel that onion as to what this is all about. And I realized as I went through this, the person who was originally the founder, Mr. Furuta, had been part of, he'd been incarcerated in Tuna Canyon, another project that I'm involved with. And I found out some history about him. He has commonality with so much of California. He was a migrant worker. He was part of a small group of people, and unlike other areas in California, they were accepted. They became part of the community there. They were accepted by the Buddhists who were directly right across the street. So I've never seen a situation where you have the local community donating to bring in the Japanese to say that they're culturally significant enough to understand religion and to have a pastor. The very first pastor does something that was pretty radical at the time. He married a Caucasian, which was against the law, and still the community of Huntington Beach accepted his marriage and the community that came with it. It was a thriving place. It has all the elements of Criterion A. It's community, the homes. It's not a high-income home. It is an example of probably middle or low-income. A church, which was the backbone of Japanese-American community. That's where everybody did everything in those days. And commerce. Goldfish. We were all, and all of us Japanese were involved with farming. And he was kind of unique in doing the goldfish farming. But it's just an amazing resource that we have here, this interconnectedness that we have. This is the only Japanese-American district in Orange County, a population of 3 million, if this is to be determined. It's the first church that we're going to be able to say that's Japanese-American in Orange County. And most of it is all there, except for the burnt manse and the original mission. But to the extent that this is very important to keep and preserve and have as a beacon to the future of our country, that we can work together between groups, between religions, local and non-local, I think is critical. It's, the community has changed to mostly Latino, but I think they can see themselves in this property. The property maintains significant integrity to be significant. We see the church and it's got its name up there. But I'll be honest, it is in a poor condition. So we don't have time to wait years and years and years for a designation. We're already at a point where we need to act. I know there's an objection out there from the owner, and even if it's eligible, I mean, if it's listed, even if this is deemed historic, it'll only be eligible and not listed, but we will work with the owner. And I note that the objection is very simple. It doesn't go to the historicity of the site, but it just goes to the fact that they object, and I'm okay with that. We'll work with the owner to make sure that we can preserve this site and have a great resource for our kids to walk through and understand what historic Wintersburg is all about. It will evoke a great memory of the Japanese Americans, of the OCBC, Orange County Buddhists, that are thriving, the Wintersburg Christian community, which is thriving, and they'll be able to reconnect to their past and I think build Orange County to a better future. So I'm open to questions and comments or issues, but like I said, this is the only one. It's the only church that we have in Orange County that's Japanese American that would be designated such. And it is the only one standing, and I think having it as a district, is critical to that understanding of what life was like then and how good we are as a community to outside groups, and how we become strong together. That's my comments.
Thank you for your comments. We will now hear from the property owner designee. We have a speaker request card from Emily Murray.
Good morning.
Morning.
Emily Murray with Alan Mackins, appearing this morning on behalf of the property owner, Nichols Street Properties, LLC. And I'd just like to provide some context for the owner's objection to the nomination. The owner has been working for several years with local preservation advocates, including Mr. Nishi, who we just heard from, and other interested parties, to achieve a long-term preservation outcome for this site. The shared goal has been to establish a permanent preservation parcel that would allow for the protection and the public appreciation of the historic Wintersburg structures, while also allowing for the balance of the approximately 4.5-acre property to be reasonably redeveloped in a way that supports the surrounding community. The parties have been actively negotiating a letter of intent under which the owner of the 4.5-acre property would donate the southern approximately 1.25 acres to serve as the historic Wintersburg preservation parcel. The parties would then work together to relocate the 1912 and 1947 Furuta homes, the 1934 Wintersburg Japanese Presbyterian Mission Building, and the related barn to that new historic Wintersburg preservation parcel at the southern end of the property. The parties have been in active discussions and negotiations for some time, but there is not a final agreement in place yet. Notwithstanding those discussions and negotiations, and without the owner's consent or participation, the community group submitted the request that's currently before you to nominate the entire 4.5-acre site for inclusion. The owner fully recognizes and acknowledges and the historical and cultural importance of the Wintersburg site and remains committed to the ongoing process to achieve a preservation outcome, but we believe that the nomination proposed doesn't accurately reflect either the configuration or the extent of the area that will ultimately be preserved. A significant portion of the 4.5-acre site no longer retains any historical integrity, and it, in our opinion, doesn't make sense to include that in the nomination. The nomination text itself acknowledges this, that apart from the four primary buildings, quote, there are no visible remnant site or landscape features associated with the former agricultural uses of the property, and the wider setting surrounding the property was transformed in the period after World War II. So we believe that this statement underscores that the historic significance of Wintersburg lies in the buildings themselves and the cultural narrative that they represent, rather than the balance of the modernized portion of the broader parcel. By extending the nomination to cover the entire 4.5 acres as the application proposes, this creates a mismatch between what is historically significant and what is proposed to be preserved. The record would then describe a resource that is larger than what conveys historic integrity and would include portions of the property that are slated for future redevelopment and that have been extensively altered and no longer contain any contributing features. The owner believes that the documentation should accurately correspond to the defined preservation parcel that may ultimately be established. And until that agreement is finalized and the buildings are relocated, the owner can't support the nomination as currently proposed and has objected to the listing. The owner nevertheless remains fully committed to the ongoing discussions intended to achieve an enduring preservation solution that would ensure that historic Wintersburg site can be permanently maintained as a dedicated space for cultural remembrance, public education, and community pride. In our opinion, the best outcome today would be for the commission to allow the nomination to be withdrawn and resubmitted at a later time to ensure that the commission's review and the public record are based on accurate and final information. The owner sincerely thanks the commission, thanks staff, and thanks the community stakeholders for their continued collaboration and mutual commitment to honoring this important chapter of California history. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Murray. Jody, are there other speakers?
Yes, Chair Hansen. We have one speaker for this item. It is... Mr. Nile or Neil Tashima. Mr. Tashima, I am allowing you to speak. If you would unmute yourself.
Good afternoon.
You have 3 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Neil Tashima. I'm a grandson of Gunjiro Tashima, who was the owner of part of the property at one point. And I want to commend the commission staff for bringing this forward as far as it's come. It's too easy to ignore the lack of physical facilities and use that as the criteria for judging cultural relevance. As a fourth generation Californian and as an anthropologist, I find both of the compelling arguments on both sides important, but I think the sense of place and belonging that had been removed from the Japanese American world by the incarceration process needs to be recognized and contributing as part of our community's contribution to the wider California sphere. So thank you very much, and I think our family would be pleased with what the state has been doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tashima. There are no other registrants who have indicated they wish to speak on this topic.
There are no additional speakers?
There are no other speakers who have indicated they wish to speak on this item.
Okay. We will now move on to the commission discussion and action. But before we do, I just wanted to read a statement about public comments that was in the meeting notice. Please note that when considering comments related to nominations for designation, the commission can only consider evidence that pertains to whether or not a property meets the criteria for listing in the National Register of Historic Places. The commission cannot consider social, economic, and environmental conditions when determining if a property meets applicable registration criteria. So I just wanted to make sure that the commission is all on the same page with that as we move forward to discussion and action. Is there discussion among the commissioners?
Question, I guess. And it actually was a question for the attorney.
For our attorney?
This woman
this,
who spoke.
This attorney, I think.
This woman who spoke here as a, yeah. She was a, yeah. she.
Right, I just wanted to clarify which attorney you were talking about.
That's this one.
So, yes.
Yes.
Emily Murray.
You made it at the end a statement. You would encourage us to allow the application to be withdrawn. I don't even know what that means. Is that a thing that, I mean?
Well, now I think that is a question for our counsel.
Well, now, okay, so that's fine. I have a question for some attorney.
So the commission can return the, not vote, or, you know, they could either vote no, the commission can vote yes, and the commission can return it back to staff with questions or, you know, a proposal. So those are the options before this commission. So you can't withdraw it. I mean, this commission could either say no or return it back to staff.
And how would we do that? Would we have a motion that said we propose? Okay.
Yes. The only person who can withdraw the nomination is the applicant.
Thank you. Any other discussion or comments? Just to clarify again before we get ahead with that, you know, this is a determination for eligibility. only, and our responsibility here is to state whether or not the applicable criteria for the National Register do apply in this case as presented in the nomination.
I'll bite. So Ms. Murray had pointed out that there's a portion of the overall property that seems to lack integrity, and you are suggesting that that not be included in the final nomination because the integrity that is retained in the property is in the buildings alone. Does the owner have a proposal on what might look like a revised version?
We do. We have a letter of intent with a number of parties that we're working on, which would limit the designation to the southern acre and a quarter of the larger 4.5-acre site and relocate the buildings in their same rough configuration to that area, and then that would be the historic preservation parcel. But that the agreement hasn't been finalized yet, so our feeling is that it's sort of premature as presented to you today because it's not the joint intent that it would remain the way it is.
So I'd just like to say that the commission's responsibility is to understand whether or not the history of the place meets the criteria for which it's being nominated. And so if the property owner contends that part of that district boundary no longer retains sufficient integrity to convey the significance, that's one thing. But if you have a plan to move things around and think about because you want something smaller, that's not the purview of the commission. So
understood.
So the question is do you have a map that you're recommending to make the district change because of this lack of integrity?
So I guess the answer to both questions is yes, although I don't have a figure to show you today. So there's the buildings themselves are currently on the northern portion of the parcel and the southern 3 acres. I don't know if there's a map that can be put up.
Do we have a map of the proposed district and the nomination?
It wasn't part of the presentation, but I'll see what I can bring up. And between the two of us, we'll see if we can post something.
Sorry, just for the record, we're looking at the paper copy of the nomination, and in it there doesn't appear to be a... Oh, there's the district boundary, I suppose. Yeah. On what page, Tara?
Sections 9 in page 50.
Page 50, section 9, there's a boundary map. Give Amy a moment to try and pull up the boundary map.
See, the difficulty is you have a non-contributor within the contributor on the southern boundary. So,
pages 49 and 50.
Pass this down, yeah. This is the, we're looking at the sketch map for the district.
Yeah. Okay, there we go. Thank you. It's on the screen now.
So the church is at the top corner of the property there, number one. Number two is the Furata house, number one. The number three is the barn. So it's our position that the buildings are the historically contributing pieces of the property, and then the balance of this 4-acre site is not contributing. Again, I do understand that it's not, you're not here to decide what a future configuration might look like or eligibility based on that, but that is the proposal is to relocate 1, 2, and 3 down to the southern portion of the property adjacent to 4, and then that would be the district parcel. And so that's the reason that we feel that, number one, it's too broadly drawn today, but number two, it doesn't reflect the intent of the parties for what the district would ultimately look like.
But in your statement, you said that there's a piece of the district that doesn't or no longer retains integrity. Is there a way for you to kind of indicate what that is on this map?
So it would essentially be everything that's not coded green and numbered. So the 1, 2, 3, and 4 are the contributing structures, and the balance of the property is just retains no contributing elements.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Commissioner Adams.
Thank you. If I understood all... Sure. If I understand all the parties, there doesn't seem to be a debate that the property is worthy of designation. It's just what portion of it is. And I'm not sure that I'm comfortable deciding what square foot is, what square foot isn't. The application before us is a certain parcel with items on both the north and south end or east and west, depending on the orientation of the map. My comfort level is to approve this, and if with further discussion it's suggested that we've overdrawn this, then it can always be pulled back. But for today's purpose, I would like to give it the protection that I believe it's due.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Julie, did you want to make a clarification before we...
I just wanted to say that I think... hold on just a second. This is being nominated as a historic district, Amy Crane? Yes?
Okay. Yes.
I just wanted to say that it's being nominated as a historic
district. Right.
And so before the commission is, does the evidence in the record support the eligibility determination, or does it support the significance of and integrity that to create that district? Jody just also let me know that the preparer has their hand up, but just to let the preparer know that the commission is deliberating, and so if they have a question for you, we will turn it to you, but the comment period's closed.
So I agree with Commissioner Adams in that we've seen district nominations come in before, and there's space between contributing elements, and it's rare that we would carve that space out and compartmentalize it to address the contributing elements. There's a continuity in a district that you want to capture with logical boundaries, and we're using the boundaries of the parcel that are, you know, then bounded by the roads in and around to start weaving a jigsaw through to eliminate acreage that might not hold a contributing element isn't really how a district is drawn up, or at least identified and then documented. So I understand that there's area within these parcels that don't contain contributing elements that still retain integrity, but it's the sum of all parts at this point. So that would be a difficult thing for me to say, well, yeah, there's open space, but they also planned where these buildings were for a reason, and I think whether it's directly or indirectly addressed in the nomination, it's not up to us to say that the field in between doesn't have integrity because there's no building sitting on it. Anyway.
Yeah, I would concur that, you know, the spaces in between the buildings provides context for this as an agricultural property. You know, it helps to tell the story clearly. I think I would support the boundaries as presented in the nomination, and I'm prepared to support the determination of eligibility as presented. Amy? Amy had a comment.
I have an additional staff note, but if you'd like to go ahead first, Commissioner, then I'll add it. Okay.
We started the nomination process with the understanding there was potential for buildings to be moved. The National Park Service recommends that buildings be recognized, be designated first, and then a request to move resources then would come back to the commission. So the recommendation is that you look at the district as it's defined. That boundary was based on how the district existed during its period of significance. And then once that process is completed and the parties involved have an opportunity to figure out what works for them, they would then come back to us with a proposal to say, we would like to move these buildings. This is how they're going to be laid out. This is how we think it still reflects as much as possible their original relationship to each other. And then basically that request would come before the commission and would continue on to the keeper in the same process that a nomination follows. And then the National Park Service would say yay or nay. If they say yes, the move can go ahead and proceed and everything remains as was determined by the original designation. If the Park Service says no, we're afraid it's going to lose too much integrity, there's some time there to have a conversation and try and work out what works best for everyone involved, particularly the resources. So it is two separate processes.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense. So that would hold true, that process, for a determination of eligibility or an actual nomination?
Well, the commission has before it a nomination with a boundary justification and components. Mm-hmm. It's up to you to decide whether you think that the criteria has been met. The negotiations and whether it comes back and all of that is a separate thing.
Okay.
And it has no bearing. I'm sorry, it doesn't have any bearing on this nomination, what you have before you. That is something that's in the future. So if you believe that the open space isn't contributing to the overall district boundary, then that's what you have to think about. So all the rest of the negotiations and whether it contains and all of that is sort of outside of the boundary of your purview today. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification. Any other comments?
I'm not certain if the vacant land is contributing or not. I honestly don't know. This particular boundary is a boundary that results from streets that were laid out later. It's somewhat arbitrary as it is. And I don't know if this is the right boundary. What I heard was a conversation going on that has been stopped. And the opposition is simply not saying this isn't significant, but has a question about whether this particular boundary as it's drawn is significant and would like the opportunity to keep discussing that with the applicant. I don't think that's an unreasonable request. It's not. There's no urgency to this. It doesn't have to be done today. And so I would suggest that we do what our attorney said you could do, which is to say, to go back and think about it some more. So that would be my suggestion.
Well, we do have an option of asking the preparer of the nomination to respond to the boundary, if we wanted to do that. Tara, you had a comment?
I just wanted to clarify the options, just to be really clear. I mean, the commission can vote yes, that it meets the criteria. The commission can vote no, that it doesn't meet the criteria. The commission could hold over to a future meeting to consider more and discuss, and then the commission can return it back to staff with questions. So those are what I see as the four options. I hope that's clear and makes sense. Okay, thank you.
Let me just clarify, though. Do all four of those options require a vote of this commission?
Absolutely.
Interest in asking the preparer of the nomination to speak to the boundaries of
yeah,
the property?
Yeah, if they're ready to. If I mean, I think that contributes to the conversation.
I think they had their hand raised.
Yeah, totally.
You as the chair can ask them questions.
Okay.
The public comment period is closed. So if you want to ask them questions,
okay.
You can. But they don't have more time to just...
Right. Okay, so can they hear me? is he still on?
I'm sorry, he just logged off.
No, he's there.
Oh, there he is now. Hello? I see. Thank you. You moved him. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Mr. Nishi, could you provide some maybe clarification for us on how the boundaries of the historic district were decided upon?
So primarily this is one contiguous parcel owned by the owner as what the original farm rested on. So the Furuta farm included this entire parcel. It did not include areas outside of this particular parcel because he did not own the other parts of the parcel. As a rural piece of land, the distance between those sites can provide or is, it would be illogical for me to just say the buildings themselves are historic because there's no architectural specialness of these sites. It's the relationship of the church, the house, the barn, and the post-war buildings on the south. And they had additional structures in the middle, which are non-contributing. But it was part of the farm that sits right in the middle of that entire area. It didn't cross Nichols Avenue. It didn't cross Emerald. It didn't cross Bell Cedar to the south. This district is one full parcel owned by one owner and transferred to one owner. It was not split off in any other direction. So I'm hopeful that we can resolve this. I know there are negotiations, but again, these buildings are not getting any younger. We've already had two buildings burn and are no longer able to be returned to the historic site. I'm not going to cry about the lost history there, but I do care about the remaining four buildings that are extant, the three on the north, but also the one at the far south is part of this whole parcel and whole historicity of this this application as a district. I'm hoping I answered some questions.
Yes, so just to clarify, you're saying that this single parcel is the historical boundaries of the property as it was originally and as it is now?
Correct.
During the period of significance for the nomination. Okay, thank you. That makes perfect sense.
I'd like to read the setting blurb under the integrity section in the nomination, because I think it sheds a little bit of light on what we're discussing. The wider setting has been compromised by later development, as the agricultural character of the area was transformed after World War II. The historic district retains the open space and rural character surrounding the four contributing buildings, even though active agricultural use has ceased. The property retains sufficient integrity of setting to convey its historic character as an early 20th century settlement associated with the Japanese-American community. So they're identifying open space and rural character as part of the setting integrity argument. While it's not identified as a contributing element, it's being used to convey integrity that remains intact as opposed to the larger farm, which has been taken away by development in and around the areas that you see not highlighted. So while we don't have a contributing element in the district that covers the open space is still being recognized as something that's used to measure integrity. And integrity thresholds are things we talk about all the time on this commission. Does it have this? Does it not have that? And that's one of the arguments of opposition, is that it doesn't retain integrity because it's not one of the contributing elements. And I don't think that's a valid enough argument, because they are looking at it from a district perspective, that the setting itself as a rural district include things that are rural, for lack of a better phrase. So I use that blurb under setting to give me a little bit more comfort in saying that I think the boundary does reflect what the district is trying to convey.
Yeah, just to add on to that, you know, the statement, a property must retain sufficient integrity to convey significance. And I would certainly support this historic configuration of the property as, again, the original boundaries not altered. And I think all of the elements in it and the open space contribute to its ability to convey its significance. So, again, I support the nomination as prepared, or the determination of eligibility.
I think you've done a lot to help the argument. You parsed those words very carefully. But the fact that there is the farming isn't taking place, that it's not a contributing element, to me is not insignificant. And the application was very careful and cleverly worded, but I will say at this moment, I could not vote yes. I doesn't mean I would vote no, but I think this conversation, I have no idea if this conversation has taken place between the applicant and the owner, but I'm going to err on the side that it hasn't and wish that it could. Because there are judgments here, and it's not like you're reading it one way and I'm not reading it the same way. To me, that lack of... And I would ask that they go back for another few months and talk about it some more. And if they can't work it out, then they can't work it out. But I just don't see the urgency.
Can I ask staff a question? We see historic districts a lot. And it is not common, in my experience, that open space is considered a contributing element. It's not listed either way as contributing or non-contributing. And I'm wondering if the preservation brief or the guidance from the National Park Service gives us clues to open space not being specifically identified as contributing or non-contributing, but just being an inherent part of a district designation. Can you maybe speak to that?
We've certainly seen it in both cases. I mean, earlier today, the golf course, which is all that open space amongst the built environment, well, that clearly is a contributing resource. It was designed and it's part of what really makes that district what it is. But again, more commonly, when you have a group of resources which are nominated as a district because of their interrelationship, there's maybe not one that's significantly more important than any of the other resources, you're actually looking at that grouping, then the space between them is just part of what holds them all together. And 15 years ago, one of my very first nominations was for an ice arena in Berkeley that was no longer up and functioning. It was still significant despite the fact that the ice had been allowed to melt. So you could make a parallel to here where the farmland is no longer actively being farmed, but you look at its relationship to the earlier house and to the barn, and you understand how this rural district existed, was established, and how it continued until various forces came into play and the period of significance closed. So I would not have brought this forward to you if I hadn't felt that the district as defined accurately represents what this district meant, how it looked, how it functioned during the period of significance.
Madam Chair. Commissioner Adams.
As I look at this nomination and site, I'm thinking about many other places.
Can you speak in
Sure, sorry, Julie. Yeah, I think about other places that are on the National Register that it's important that their context and setting are part of that nomination. Where this was an agricultural property, it seems to me that all of this shows that context. I think about the first time I saw the Alamo in Texas, and you've got skyscrapers within feet of it, and it's completely lost its place because of things encroaching upon it. So I would hate to see this whittled down. From what we have in the record, this has been delayed at least once. And again, I don't see a reason to delay it. And my concern is if it is delayed, what happens while it's delayed? So I'm much more wanting to err on the side of caution and preserve this site so that nothing else happens to it. Thanks.
Commissioner Cerullo?
I think Renee would like to say something.
Commissioner Milano.
Thank you.
Go for it.
Thank you, Chair. Honestly, I'm not as confused as perhaps some of my other commissioner colleagues here. This seems pretty intact to me. This seems pretty readily justifiable. I look at the agricultural aspects of it, and I see the connections of the buildings. And I think it's important for us to understand setting and why historic preservation even exists. And I always go back to this, the children's book, The Little House by Virginia Lee Butler, where we look, where the reason historic preservation exists is because things change. Because things change, and to the point where we lament the fact that we didn't stop and say, hey, we should have preserved that part of who we are. And when I look at this boundary, I'm not confused at all. I think it's even stronger with the agricultural and space connections between the buildings, the fields. And I think about my own property in Sierra Madre. There's a house and a back house, and there's a wonderful fruit orchard in between. That property does not exist in the way it should exist and has existed in our family without that fruit orchard in between. That every winter we go and get the grapefruits, we get the lemons, we get the limes. That in other parts of the year we get the avocado trees. I cannot imagine that piece of property in Sierra Madre up against the San Gabriel Hills being divided, and I think other commissioners have said it, being divided and compartmentalized without that significant fruit area that connected the two, the back house and the front house. And I see this in the same way. Looking at the totality of the setting, the significance of how the period of significance, that's why we have period of significance with that understanding that things have changed, and there's every once in a while, hopefully every quarter, that we get to look at properties and say, wait a minute, this does still hold an important, significant aspect to our culture, to our heritage, and to the properties that are no longer like that. I know that Orange County had more agricultural areas there. I know that Orange County has changed significantly to the point where this piece of property intact, defined as is, prevents a significant, provides us an opportunity to nominate a significant piece of property with the agricultural fields, with the trails in between, with the boundaries as defined here in this nomination. Thank you.
Thanks.
Commissioner Cerullo.
Yeah, just to follow up, there's a lot of language in the nomination about the agricultural industry and what they were growing in these areas, including the property in question. And so just because the ag field doesn't identify itself as a contributing element from a rural standpoint, I'm looking at the mechanics of what a district does and what it is, and the binder are those spaces between the built environment. So whether you call them out as contributing elements or not, to Amy's point, sometimes you have them and sometimes you don't. And then the nomination then has to make that argument that the district's boundary is what it is, not because you have streets on either side and that's what you have left, but rather it's a district. It's a contiguous set of resources that convey some form of action that was historically significant during the period of significance. And so, you know, they don't farm that anymore, I think is fine. I think it still conveys that feeling of rural agricultural industry and that we still have built environment there. So that's okay. And Commissioner Payton, your points are well made. And I think my familiarity with how the districts are drawn up and why we include things and don't include things are to, again, convey that the resources exist, but then there are things that happened in and about, and that's why you make a district, not just individual buildings, is that you're trying to identify everything that took place there. So I feel comfortable enough to say that the space in between should still be considered, and I understand that there are things that are happening behind the scenes and after this, and that's great, but that's not the evidence we're asked to judge today. So based on just the integrity of the nomination itself, I think it's sound and it hasn't missed anything, and that there's nothing that isn't contributing within the rectangle.
Any more discussion? Are we ready to make a motion?
Or more motions? We could have. Do we vote on one, or can we have a set if Neil would like to?
Okay.
Vote
on one motion at a time.
Okay.
So somebody needs to make a motion.
Somebody needs to make a motion, and then you need to wait a second. So don't anyone jump in, and then somebody seconds it until everyone's.
Commissioner Adams wants
the
to
motion.
Make a motion.
Yeah.
Commissioner Adams.
I would make a motion to.
Microphone.
Sorry. I would make a motion to determine Wintersburg is eligible at the local level of significance under National Register Criterion A with a 1908 to 1965 period of significance.
Yeah, you good? We have a motion by Commissioner Adams to approve the determination of eligibility as presented. And is there a second?
I'll second it.
Okay, we have a second.
I've been talking. So.
Commissioner Cerrillo. Tara, maybe you have a roll call.
Thank you. Chairperson Adams.
Aye.
Chairperson Payton.
Am I allowed to abstain?
Yes.
Abstain.
Commissioner Cerrillo.
Aye.
Commissioner Vanellowith.
Aye.
Madam Chair Hansen.
Yes.
Thank you very much. The vote carries 4-0-1. Thank you.
All right. Are you good? All right. We are now moving on to number 8 on the agenda, the progress report for the National Register of Historic Places. The National Register Park Service notice of listings identified those properties that have been listed in the National Register or determined eligible for listing. Properties listed or determined eligible for listing in the National Register are automatically listed in the California Register of Historical Resources. Since the last regular meeting of the Commission, the Office of Historic Preservation has been notified about properties listed or determined eligible, and those are reflected in your agenda. Okay, moving on to Commission discussion and action. We have the election of chairperson and vice chairperson for 20. Oh, sorry.
Sorry to interrupt. We have not dealt with the California Historic Landmark nomination.
It was
yes, we did. It was
okay,
on consent.
Gotcha. Yep. Okay, thank you.
can I just go out of call and say, Ms. Murray, thank you for your patience today. We understand that your client and the nominator are working together, and we hope that you can continue to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Sorry. Now we will move on to commission discussion action, election of chair and vice chair for 2026. Commissioners Cerrillo and Adams served as the election committee, so I'm going to turn over the discussion to them.
After performing an exhaustive search, we had one response, and that response was, I'm good, essentially. So Lee and I have talked about this to try to figure out, you know, what are our options? How do we make this fair and easy? And here were our thoughts. Since nobody really wanted to serve in the chair and vice chair capacity for next year, we've both done it before, and we've both agreed that we're happy to do it again in 2026 in either configuration. And if you'd like us to then flip in 2027, we could do that too, which would allow for this kind of transitional period for the commission to bring some new staff in and not have to worry about who would serve in those roles, who might be new or not familiar with it. So either way, we're both offering ourselves up, and we just want to say that it's a privilege to serve, and whatever we feel is best for the commission, we're happy to do that.
So we have to decide amongst ourselves who's it for?
We didn't want to decide for you. We felt that was a little presumptuous.
Okay, well, then I will put it out there to the commission to, is there a motion, or do you have a candidate you would like to propose for chair? That would be a no. Okay, well, then I guess a little wink or something.
Flip a coin, dude.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm going to make a motion to nominate Adam as chair for next year, and if it's not too egotistical, myself is vice chair.
Okay. So then we have a motion.
I'd like to nominate Lee for
to nominate Adam Cerrero as 2026
sure.
chair of the commission,
sure?
and Commissioner Adams as vice chair for 2026. Do we have a second?
I'll second that. I like that.
All right. Do we need a roll call on that?
Who's the second?
Renee.
Vilanowit. Commissioner Vilanowit.
No. Oh, the second was by. Yeah. Or I'm sorry. I thought you meant.
We could nominate Brian because he's not here. But I think that would be mean.
Okay.
Or Alan. Oh, my God, we forgot about Alan.
Okay, so you have a motion and a second.
Great. So just to make it fair, I'm going to call commissioners in a different order than I normally do. Commissioner Payton.
Aye.
Commissioner Vilanowit.
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen.
Aye.
Commissioner Adams.
Aye.
And Commissioner Schriro.
Aye.
Congratulations. The motion carries 500.
And thank you.
Okay, congratulations to the new chair and vice chair for 2026. And on that note, the next item is meeting dates for 2026, and we have some proposed meeting dates. Did you want me to hold on a second? Do you want to hold on a second? Okay. So I'm going to just let you all know quickly the proposed dates for 2026 are Thursday and Friday, February 5th and 6th, Thursday and Friday, May 7th and 8th, Thursday and Friday, August 6th and 7th, and Thursday and Friday, November 5th and 6th. And we need to discuss whether or not those dates are going to work for everyone.
And no voting needed.
And we do have, are we just saying yes right now? We're not?
Correct.
Okay, and then because we do have two commissioners who need to weigh in that are not here today as well.
Everybody's been notified.
Yes.
I did receive confirmation from Commissioner Brandis, maybe Commissioner Huss, that said they had no conflicts.
Okay. Does anyone else have conflicts with those dates?
I'm double-checking on August, but right now, no, but I'd like to just get back to you with that.
Okay.
I think the most important thing is the February date.
Yeah.
Okay. So are we good on that item?
Okay.
Shippo Palanco, are we good to
move I'm on? Good, okay. Yeah. Let's keep it that way. Right. If we need, we can look at August later if we need to do that, but most important to get the Q1 meeting on the calendar because we have noticing requirements starting, like, next week.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
We're moving on to public comments, and these would be items other than those that were on the agenda today. So anyone wishing to address the commission about items not on the agenda will be given 3 minutes to speak. And, Jody, do we have speakers signed up?
We do, Chair Hansen. We have one speaker right now. I will call on Richard Rothman. Mr. Rothman, I am allowing you to speak. If you would unmute yourself.
Okay,
you have 3 minutes, Mr. Rothman. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Richard Rothman, and I'm an alumni of George Washington High School in San Francisco. And we submitted an application to be listed for your commission to review. It's been over like 6 months. This application was originally prepared by the Planning Department of San Francisco and submitted by a consultant who does excellent work. And what frustrates us is very hard to communicate with the commission staff. And, you know, if there's a problem with it, we'd like to know and help address it. But not wanting to communicate is very frustrating. I've tried phone calling, and I just get a curse email response. And, you know, I had to end up doing a record request, a sunshine request, and it's going to take 45 to 60 days. That's really unacceptable. And, you know, this building was built by Timothy Pfluger. It has New Deal architect WPA murals in the building. And it's a quite historic building. And I don't see why this is taking so long to process the application. I mean, if they have a problem, they should, you know, communicate with us and not keep stonewalling. And the other thing, I wish maybe public comment would be at the beginning of the meeting. A lot of the meetings I attend, quite a few where I give public comment, and public comment for the most part is at the beginning of the meeting, or have it, one commission have it at the beginning and the ending of the meeting. So back to my point, I hope staff, if they have a problem, they will communicate. And, you know, to me, it only needs to be read by once or twice because the application was, you know, had all the information that was needed to process it. So maybe you can ask the staff to be more forthful in communicating and what is the problem. And they have my contact information. I've communicated with them. And so I thank you for your consideration and for the work you do. Bye.
Thank you, Mr. Rothman. We have no further public comment.
And I'm assuming there's no one in the room for public comment.
There's no one in the room.
Well, there's people in the room, just not public.
Yeah.
Okay, now we're going to move on to commissioner comments. Any commissioners have comments to share?
Two quick ones. I would like to request an update in the February meeting for the California Historical Resources Information System. I know a lot's gone on with grants and dollars and who knows how many federal dollars we all might have now versus then or whatever have you, but love to get an update on where we are with that.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And then my second comment was, it was great to hear everybody thank the registration unit, William and Amy, for all the hard work they're doing. The nominations are very well put together, and notwithstanding the last speaker's comments about anything that may or may not be aware in the registration unit, just you guys are doing a great job, and you make it very easy for us up here, so thank you.
And Monica, Caleb, Jody, thanks for...
Yeah, everybody.
Thanks.
Even
for
the ones in the back.
Kevin.
Yeah.
Kevin, thank you. And I just also thank you for that. I just wanted to quickly... I was remiss in my comments earlier to also acknowledge the review staff we have who don't come to the commission meetings and don't have a public forum, but their work and their dedication, their excellence, especially with the amount of reviews that we do, 5,000 a year, or so in Section 106 alone is phenomenal. And so I just wanted to also recognize them.
Any other commissioners? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to ditto what Adam said with the staff, both in the room and not in the room. For the time I've been on this commission, their work has been unbelievable. Also, thank you for your support of having me in the chairs again. And I've gotten to do a lot of things in this life, but I don't know that I've ever had a better privilege of serving 40 million Californians in this role. It every day and every time I get on the website to look at things or messages from you folks, it reminds me I have no idea how this happened, but I'm internally grateful for it. So thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, then I will adjourn this meeting at 1:27 p.m.
Thank you, Madam Chair.